Investigation led by former judge Sir Brian Langstaff was announced by ex-Prime Minister Theresa May back in 2017 and seems to be finally approaching its conclusion. Earlier this month, one of the ministers at the center of the scandal, John Major, was forced to apologize after saying the victims had incredibly bad luck. Major had previously written that it was unwise to give a sympathetic view to the victims, as this might open the government up to culpability, a view that disgusts those still working with patients.
Even more damaging than the actual medical error itself, and you know, I'm a doctor, I've been involved in medical error, it's an inevitable part of life, an inevitable part of medical practice, but the attitude towards that transparency and honesty and admission of mistakes to prevent further harm being done is at the heart of good medical ethics. And what we see here is at the highest governmental level, an open admission that there was knowledge, but action wouldn't be taken either to acknowledge the error, to take steps to stop further people being infected, perhaps. And certainly, at the heart of all of this was the worry about money.
Due to medical advances and the more robust fashion in which blood products are screened before even getting to the patient, the likelihood of another Factor VIII scandal is highly unlikely. But according to experts, the race to weaken the NHS means another health crisis is just around the corner. Representatives of the current government have pledged to abide by the results and recommendation of the probe. But for many of those affected and the loved ones they've left behind, anything will be too little, too late. Amina Taylor, London.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip are preparing for Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, amid dire economic conditions. The sacred Muslim occasion comes at the end of the Hajj season, and it will be observed in Palestine on Saturday. Gazans have been observing Eid al-Adha under a tight Israeli siege since 2007. Muslims around the world buy new clothes, special gifts, and sweets for their loved ones on this festive occasion, but most Gazans can't afford such luxury.
We're trying to make our children happy during Eid, but things are really tough. Most of us are just going around the markets unable to afford Eid gifts for our families. The economic situation is very bad and has been getting worse by the year due to the blockade.
People are seen browsing the merchandise lining the streets and sidewalks of Gaza and hardly buying anything. They shop for long hours to try and find affordable gifts for their families.
During the holidays before the blockade, I used to buy a lot of clothes and gifts for my children, but nowadays I just buy them a few things. I have been coming to the market for 3 days now, trying to find something that I can afford.
According to UN figures, some 80% of Gazans depend on humanitarian aid to survive. Experts say the Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has devastated Gaza's economy and worsened the living conditions.
The Israeli blockade has been in place for a very long time and is the main reason for the weak purchasing power during Eid al-Adha. The majority of people in Gaza have a limited income, and more than 60% of the population suffers from poverty and unemployment. People are having a very hard time during the holidays, and they can hardly afford to put food on the table.
All happy occasions in this impoverished territory have been marred by the blockade and Israeli atrocities in recent years.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are preparing themselves for Eid al-Adha holiday, despite the dire straits facing them due to the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Taxi drivers have staged a nationwide strike against the government's plan to deregulate the sector. The industrial action was called by a string of unions representing cab drivers in opposition to Article 10 of a competition bill linked to the reforms the EU requires in exchange for the funding of Italy's post-COVID National Recovery and Resilience Fund. Unionists say that the regulation will open cab drivers up to unfair competition from web-based ride-sharing services.
A law that regulates our sector was already approved 3 years ago, and the EU doesn't require further amendments. Taxi fares are presently regulated by local authorities. Prices would go ballistic if we let the privates take over. A deregulation would favour multinationals over independent drivers. Full stop.
On Monday, a protest called by unionists in Rome's central quarters led to disruption to traffic and buses in the Italian capital. The demonstration ended up in clashes with police. On Tuesday, tens of cab drivers gathered at Rome's municipality, asking local authorities to take their side. Protests were also held in Milan and other Italian cities. Like taxi drivers across the European Union, Italy's licensed cabbies have been protesting ever since private hired services such as Uber arrived on the scene in 2014. An endless series of strikes and protests against the liberalization of the sector have been staged over the years.
This government works for the almighty dollar, that's it. We are in the midst of an unprecedented economic crisis, and what does the executive do? It gives multinationals more privileges. What about us, the people?
Tension within the broad coalition supporting Prime Minister Mario Draghi's government was high over the competition bill until not long ago. However, a split in the once anti-establishment five-star movement, with Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio embracing Draghi's more pro-market views, seems to have calmed down the churning waters of Italian politics. Max Civili, Rome.
Over a million Muslims converged on the Arafat desert in Saudi Arabia as the biggest Hajj pilgrimage since the beginning of the pandemic is nearing its climax. Arafat signifies the high point of the Hajj pilgrimage, where the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, delivered his final sermon, calling for equality and unity among Muslims.
Actually, Hajj season is of supreme importance because they have been all brought together for the unity of the Islamic Ummah. God could tell everybody to stay in their own home country and do the prayer, say the prayer, and do Hajj rituals. But it wasn't do so because God wanted to bring all the Islamic Ummah together so that they could get to know each other and communicate with one another. This is the importance of the unity of Hajj.
The pilgrims set out for Arafat before dawn and spent the night in deep contemplation. They also gathered on the Mountain of Mercy, offering prayers of repentance. Muslims believe prayers in Arafat are the best opportunity for salvation and spiritual renewal.
Arafat is a very sacred and holy place because all Muslims from around the globe have to attend here and get together. There are some rituals which are usually done, one of which is saying Arafat dua, which was actually initiated by Imam Hussein, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him. The other importance of this, let's say, land, this holy land, is that Imam al-Zaman, Imam Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, is also here. The only problem is that the people here don't recognize who he is, though he is doing the rituals with the Islamic Ummah.
Staying in Arafat is one of the main parts of Hajj. The stay of pilgrims is said to lead to forgiveness of their sins. After staying in Arafat until nightfall, pilgrims will march or take a bus to the desert of Muzdalifah to collect pebbles to carry out the symbolic stoning of the devil later in Mina on Saturday. Mahdi Abbasian, Arafat Desert.
It is clearly now the will of the Parliamentary Conservative Party that there should be a new leader of that party and therefore a new prime minister.
Boris Johnson led his party to a landslide victory in the 2019 election. Little did he know he wouldn't even see through his first term, undone by multiple scandals and by flaws in his character that critics say made him unfit for office. The coronavirus pandemic offered Boris Johnson a perfect cocktail of crises and chaos that shifted attention from other problems.
Boris Johnson promised to get Brexit done, but nearly 2 years on, his country is still mired in a dispute with the European Union. The IMF says the UK will have the slowest economic growth of the G7 nations next year. Add to that the rising cost of living and also the faltering health and education systems.
Success with the vaccine program helped mitigate the frustration over Johnson's dithering and delays in following scientific advice that contributed to one of the highest death tolls in the developed world and almost took his life. His leadership style and character flaws always acted as ammunition for his critics and the opposition.
He's inflicted lies, fraud and chaos in the country. And, you know, we're stuck with a government which isn't functioning in the middle of a cost of living crisis.
Then came the Partygate scandal. The Conservative Party was now in crisis. Johnson received wide support for his backing of the Ukrainian government in the ongoing military conflict in the country. But the Partygate scandal refused to go away. He received a police fine for attending one of multiple lockdown-breaching parties in Downing Street, becoming the first sitting British Prime Minister to have broken the law.
Mr. Speaker, I want to apologize.
Eventually, 148 of his own MPs, 40% of the parliamentary party, turned against him in a vote of no confidence. He survived it and staggered on. And then it emerged he had known about this man, Chris Pincher's, sexual misconduct and appointed him to a powerful position still. Within days, the man, nicknamed the Great Political Survivor, was forced to throw in the towel. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Tehran, the capital of Iran, and now a destination for investors. Tehran Investment Summit brought together businesses, mayors, and urban development officials from Iran and the world to explore areas of investment in Tehran.
It's so important for us to participate in here, and we consider as a not only for a relationship between two cities, it's in the, including for the relationship between two countries.
2 years ago, the Iranian and Nicaraguan capitals, Tehran and Managua, signed an MOU that named them as sister cities. Now, with the Tehran Investment Summit, there is a chance for Managua to further cooperate with Tehran in launching urban development projects.
210 projects covering waste management, transport, and tourism, among others, will be introduced to investors in the two-day conference. The projects total roughly $71 billion. Tehran municipality says if those projects are accomplished, they will revolutionize the Iranian capital.
This is the start of a turning point in Tehran's development. This conference was inaugurated today, but it has no closing ceremony. The exhibition section of the event will continue to run permanently to highlight any area that needs investment. This will transform Tehran's future.
Being among the busiest cities means that Tehran is inevitably among the most polluted places in the world. Municipal authorities say they also welcome any investment in controlling air pollution in Tehran.
Eliminating air pollution and traffic congestions are among the major challenges in Tehran, which can be solved permanently through the promotion of clean transportation. I'm certain that many investors would love to invest in this area.
Attracting foreign investment has long been a challenge for Iran as a result of U.S. sanctions that restrict global banking transactions with Iran.
I would not say that sanctions will not affect foreign investment, but we are focusing on the private sector, which acts separately from governments. Meanwhile, the Central Bank of Iran has also promised to support foreign investors should they take part in Tehran's development projects.
Life in the Iranian capital is a mixed experience of modernity and antiquity, as it's home to both skyscrapers and historic buildings, together making it a hot tourist target. But tourism is only one of the countless capacities for investment in Tehran, as it's home to some 15 million residents, and with a large population comes a wide array of interests and businesses.
As the capital of Iran, Tehran has numerous opportunities for investors, from tourism to transport and pollution control projects. Many of those projects have so far been running based on citizen participation or tax revenues. Now, Tehran municipality says with its approach shifting toward investment, the development of the metropolis is expected to accelerate. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
America and the world would be far safer places if this outrageous spending was drastically cut and those funds redirected to moral investments in people, society, and planetary health, not war and weapons, says William Hartung, author, in an article published under the heading America's $1.4 trillion so-called national security budget makes us less safe, not more. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. This March, when the Biden administration presented a staggering $813 billion proposal for national defense, it was hard to imagine a budget that could go significantly higher or be more generous to the denizens of the military-industrial complex. After all, that request represented far more than peak spending in the Korean or Vietnam War years, and well over $100 billion more than at the height of the Cold War. It was, in fact, an astonishing figure by any measure, more than 2.5 times what China spends. More, in fact, than, and hold your hats, for this one, the national security budgets of the next 9 countries, including China and Russia combined. And yet the weapons industry and hawks in Congress are now demanding that even more be spent. In recent National Defense Authorization Act proposals, which always set a marker for what Congress is willing to fork over to the Pentagon, the Senate and the House Armed Services Committees both voted to increase the 2023 budget yet again by $45 billion in the case of the Senate and $37 billion for the House. The final figure won't be determined until later this year, but Congress is likely to add tens of billions of dollars more than even the Biden administration wanted to what will most likely be a record for the Pentagon's already bloated budget. This lust for yet more weapons spending is especially misguided at a time when a never-ending pandemic, growing heat waves, and other depredations of climate change and racial and economic injustice are devastating the lives of millions of Americans. Make no mistake about it. The greatest risk to Americans' safety and their future are non-military in nature. With the exception, of course, of the threat of nuclear war, which could increase if the current budget goes through as planned. But as Tom Dispatch readers know, the Pentagon is just one element in an ever more costly American national security state. Adding their military, intelligence, and internal security expenditures to the Pentagon's budget brings the total upcoming national security budget to a mind-boggling $1.4 trillion. And note that in June 2021, the last time the Mandy Smithberger and other authors add up such cost to the taxpayer, that figure was almost $1.3 trillion, so the trend is obvious. To understand how these vast sums are spent year after year, let's take a quick tour of America's national security budget, top to bottom. The Pentagon's proposed base budget, which includes all of its routine expenses from personnel to weapons to the cost of operating and maintaining a 1.3 million member military force, came in at $773 billion for 2023, more than $30 billion above that 2022. Such an increase alone is three times the discretionary budget of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and more than three times the total allocation for the Environmental Protection Agency. In all, the Pentagon consumes nearly half of the discretionary budget of the whole federal government, a figure that's come down slightly in recent years thanks to the Biden administration's increased investment in civilian activities. That still means, however, that almost anything the government wants to do other than preparing for or waging war involves a scramble for funding, while the Department of Defense, better to say, the Department of War, gets virtually unlimited financial support. And keep in mind that the proposed Biden increase in Pentagon spending comes despite the ending of 20 years of U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan, a move that should have meant significant reductions in the department's budget. Perhaps you won't be surprised to learn, however, that in the wake of the Afghan disaster, the military establishment and hawks in Congress quickly shifted gears to touting and exaggerating challenges posed and inflation as reasons for absorbing the potential savings from the Afghan war and pressing the Pentagon budget ever higher. It's worth looking at what America stands to receive for its $773 billion, or about $2,000 per taxpayer, according to an analysis by the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. More than half of that amount goes to giant weapons contractors like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, along with thousands of smaller arms-making firms. The most concerning part of the new budget proposal, however, may be the administration's support for a three-decades-long $1.7 trillion plan to build a new generation of nuclear-armed missiles, as well, of course, as new warheads to go with them, bombers and submarines. As the organization Global Zero has pointed out, the United States could dissuade any country from launching an atomic attack against it with far fewer weapons than are contained in its current nuclear arsenal. There is simply no need for a costly and risky nuclear weapons modernization plan. Sadly, it's guaranteed to help fuel a continuing global nuclear arms race. While entrenching nuclear weapons as a mainstay of national security policy for decades to come, wouldn't those decades be so much better spent working to eliminate nuclear weapons together? The riskiest weapon in that nuclear plan is a new land-based intercontinental ballistic missile ICBM. As former Secretary of Defense William Perry once explained, ICBMs are among the most dangerous weapons in the world because a president warned of a nuclear attack would have only a matter of minutes to decide whether to launch them, increasing the risk of an accidental nuclear war based on a false alarm. Not only is a new ICBM unnecessary, but the existing ones should be retired as well as a way of reducing the potential for a world-ending nuclear conflagration. To its credit, Biden administration is trying to get rid of an ill-conceived nuclear weapons program initiated during the Trump years, a sea-launched nuclear-armed cruise missile that, rather than adding a deterrent capability, would raise the risk of a nuclear confrontation. As expected, nuclear hawks in the military and Congress are trying to restore funding for that nuclear SLCM, pronounced SLCM. The Pentagon budget is replete with other unnecessary, overpriced, and often potentially dysfunctional systems that should either be canceled or replaced with more affordable and effective alternatives. The most obvious case in point is the F-35 combat aircraft meant to carry out multiple missions for the Air Force, Navy, and Marines. So far, it does not do them. In a series of careful analyses of the aircraft, the project on government oversight determined that it may never be fully ready for combat. As for the cost, at an estimated $1.7 trillion over its projected period of service, it's already the most expensive single weapons program ever undertaken by the Pentagon. And keep in mind that those costs will only increase as the military services are forced to pay to fix problems that were never addressed in the rush to deploy the plane before it was fully tested. Meanwhile, that aircraft is so complex that at any given moment, a large percentage of the fleet is down for maintenance, meaning that if ever called on for combat duty, many of those planes will simply not be available. In a grudging acknowledgement of the multiple problems plaguing the F-35, the Biden administration proposed decreasing its buy of the plane by about a third in 2023, a figure that should have been much lower given its poor performance. But congressional advocates of the plane, including a large F-35 caucus made up of members in states or districts where parts of it are being produced, will undoubtedly continue to press for more planes than even the Pentagon's asking for, as the Senate Armed Services Committee did its markup of the Department of Defense spending bill. In addition to all of this, the Pentagon's base budget includes mandatory spending for items like military retirement, totaling an estimated $12.8 billion for 2023. Running national insecurity tally is $785.8 billion.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Love him or hate him, Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, has resigned. Scandal after scandal, he survived the knockout punches, but the mass resignations were just too many, practically leaving him without a cabinet to run the country. The drama may not be over, since there are still those who want him to leave power immediately and not stay on until October, when a leadership race will determine who will be the next Prime Minister. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Johnson's legacy, how he improved or hurt the UK, and what guarantees there are that the next UK Prime Minister or his cabinet or her cabinet will be any better. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Professor of Economics and political commentator Rodney Shakespeare joins us from London. Also joining us, journalist and commentator James Tweedy, who joins us from Plymouth in the UK.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. What a 48 hours it has been, Rodney Shakespeare. Let me first start with you. And looking at the British Prime Minister resignation, of course, the rebellion that came from the Conservatives, unhappy with the scandals, as we understand, surrounding his premiership. Do you think that this was just all about the scandals, or perhaps somebody had an eye on his post or his position, and maybe something went on in that respect, which amounted to all these resignations, which we understand were over 60 at this point?
It's much worse than the immediate scandals, like the costs of the wallpaper in the Downing Street flat, like not telling the truth about what he knew about someone he appointed to a government post, about the sad situation in which there were parties when other people could not be with their dying relatives. Behind this are two great big things in which was catching the Conservatives, and which is going to catch Labour and the Liberals, the whole political establishment. The first is, and you can go back, say, to 2008, is that certain malfunctions in the economy not understood, and their attempts to overcome them meant that they were pumping money and not addressing the problems. And the inflation was rising before the business in Ukraine. That is going on and has been accentuated by Ukraine, and none of them have an answer. They try and raise interest rates, they will collapse the economy. Now, the second thing going on, and they're all complicit in this, it's gone on for 25 years. It's, say, 1997, when, breaking an agreement, of course, the West started to expand NATO to the east. Russia wasn't strong enough to do anything. But the purpose of moving thousands of kilometers to the east was to put hypersonic nuclear missiles right up against Russia. And of course, Russia is never allowed to have hypersonic nuclear missiles right against the USA. You then come to 2014, when there was a fascist coup. And I'll tell you what they're not telling you. The coup overthrew a democratically elected president and put into power fascist Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians whose policy was and is to kill Russian-speaking Ukrainians. Now, the whole of the British political establishment is committed to that fascist regime, which, by the way, has got rid of all the political parties in Ukraine. Don't talk to me about democracy there. Mm-hmm. The whole of the political establishment in the UK is committed to an understanding of economics and finance to which they have no solution. I got my energy bills today. I won't tell you. They were eye-watering. And at the same time, they are locked in like a train which cannot slow down into this Ukrainian policy, which they are making worse. And even today, the Americans are going to put more sanctions on Iran to stop Iranian oil coming into the market. They're locked into disaster. It goes through all the political parties in the UK. And I'm afraid the whole situation is going to get worse.
Well, that's not very promising, is it?
We were going to
get into the economic side of this whole thing a little bit later on, which I'm going to leave for a little bit later on so I can get an immediate reaction from you, if I may, James Tweedy, about just the whole affair here of what has transpired. I mean, things really in UK politics, no one would have really thought that this would happen in the course of the past 24, 48 hours in the way that it did. Looking at some of the reactions, Nicola Sturgeon is what I'd like to ask from you, the first minister of the first Scottish minister. She said it is just an unsustainable proposition to say that he's going to continue to inhabit number 10. I'm not sure anybody could look at Boris Johnson and conclude that he is capable of genuinely behaving as a caretaker prime minister. Why do you think there's such a push? It's not just her saying that. Why do you think this approach towards Johnson, like what we're seeing from Nicola Sturgeon?
It's like Mr. Shakespeare said, it's about the economic crisis. It's not really about one of his MPs going to a private members club with other Tory MPs and other Tory party members and, getting drunk and touching two of them up. You know, that's not even Johnson's fault that the man behaved like that, you know. It's because of the country's in crisis. You've got the crisis of rampant inflation, you know, inflation heading towards 11% soon, because of the sanctions that, you know, it's all self-inflicted. It's because of the sanctions that we've put on Russia and the oil and gas embargo we've put on Russia. And things like, household utilities, household gas and electricity and filling up your car. The prices of those things are doubling. So this is the real problem. This is what's making the government unpopular. But like Mr. Shakespeare said, there's nobody who wants to change that. Nicola Sturgeon, a couple of months ago, called for a no-fly zone over the Ukraine, a NATO-imposed no-fly zone. Boris Johnson said that would lead to World War III. So Nicola Sturgeon is not a serious person. Her whole, her whole focus is on trying to rerun the independence referendum that she failed to win, or her party failed to win, back in 2014, and nobody wants that. And this is the thing. So, this leads into one of the reasons why Johnson is probably going to be able to stay on, because, you know, his party, What happened to him was normal in the Conservative Party. Exactly the same thing happened to Theresa May. That's why Boris Johnson became leader and prime minister. You know, the same thing happened to Margaret Thatcher. You know, they all survived a no confidence vote by the backbenchers. But then, you know, things got worse. The crisis got worse, and people came to have a quiet word with them, and they resigned. You know, some ministers resigned and spoke out against them. That happened to Thatcher. But now what? Now where are they going? Well, he's staying on. Now people say it's untenable or it's weird. Well, okay, someone's got to be prime minister until the new one is elected, you know, which is also normal. It's all normal to change prime ministers like that in Britain. You know, the only way they've got to get rid of him, if they don't like it, is to have a parliamentary no confidence vote, which means an immediate, in the government, not in him, but in the government, which means an immediate snap general election. And if that happens, firstly, as things stand with the party's popularity, a lot of those MPs, those Conservative MPs, would lose their seats and their lucrative jobs in that election, and then you would end up probably most likely a hung parliament with Labour, maybe as the largest party, forming a coalition with the Liberal Democrats and the Scottish National Party, and the SNP would demand another referendum. And in fact, they'll demand one every parliament or every couple of years, even until Scottish people get bored of it and vote to leave the UK, possibly, or just get rid of, you know, stop voting for the Scottish National Party, perhaps. Okay. But that's probably a non-starter. And, you know, as Mr. Shakespeare said, it's very hard to see any of the potential candidates, because two of the favourites are Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, and Liz Truss, the Foreign Secretary, who are both the leading proponents of the war, even more, as much as Johnson, or more so, the war in Ukraine. or backing Ukraine in its war against Russia. And they're not going to change policy. They're not going to change the policy that's causing the basic problem of inflation.
Sure. Well, I mean, where can I start with this whole affair, Rodney Shakespeare, of the unstable situation that the government is facing? I mean, can it be called a government at this point? I mean, we're looking at October being the date that there's going to be a Passover from the caretaker PM to the whoever is going to get picked. But what's going to happen until then? I mean, we know the state of affairs in the UK, as you just said, the cost of energy is so high. Your electric bill, you can't even mention it because it brought tears to your eyes or made your eyes water. I mean, how is this government going to even function, especially given the fact you got 60 ministers who have resigned, even though there's been a new cabinet that's already put in place from what we understand?
James referred to a confidence motion, and he also said or indicated that that won't happen because those Conservative MPs will lose their seats. There's another possibility. The Prime Minister is the Queen's Prime Minister, and it is conceivable that a quiet word would suggest to Boris that he should go. But that the Queen must have a Prime Minister. And I believe that Theresa May, I think, is indicating that she's not willing. So the chances are that Boris will stay as Prime Minister until the Conservatives get themselves organised. As regards who will come through, the trouble is you've got a whole batch of second-rate candidates. And just do a thought experiment. Who can you think of who could have a raft of new policy to solve the problems, who could unite the Conservative Party, and who could appeal to the whole of the country, and who is able to rethink major policy, e.g. on sanctions on Ukraine, and you can't think of anyone. So there's the problem for the Conservative Party. This is going to drag on. The situation is going to get worse. British politics is going to go into a sort of melting point as these big issues, as James is indicating, as these big issues start to play and have more obvious effect.
Well, since we've talked about the Ukraine conflict, I have to ask you, James Tweedy, about what the Russian ambassador to the UK has said. And he said that Britain's Boris Johnson's fall was just a reward for what he said, a belligerent anti-Russian policy of support for Ukraine, while ignoring the economic needs of the British people, that he concentrated too much on the geopolitical situation on Ukraine. Do you think he had a point?
Yeah, that's justifiable. That's what both of us have been saying so far. And others have said, some bloggers like Larry Johnson, who's an American conservative but anti-war blogger, Andrei Martyanov, who's a Russian who lives and works in the US, that this is just going to be the start. Johnson isn't going to be the first prime minister or president to go because of this. Over in the States, Joe Biden is facing defeat in the midterm elections in November, and then his future starts to look uncertain. People can see that he's not compos mentis. He's losing his marbles. In France, Emmanuel Macron, the president, has lost his governing majority in parliament, and the parties that picked up seats were the National Rally now. It used to be the National Front, and a coalition of left wing parties led by Jean-Luc Mélenchon. And both of those are against the war and essentially against NATO membership, and so on. And it will, and there are other governments. The Dutch government is very vulnerable because they've decided to bankrupt the farming industry in their country on some pretext of ecological reasons, and the farmers have blocked all the motorways and you can't get food into the supermarkets, and that's spreading to Belgium now. So all these governments are going to start coming down because the whole of Europe is in crisis, you see. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the ambassador is justified in that, and it's not going to, you know, this is just the beginning.
Sure. What is this committee that's going to, at this point, Rodney Shakespeare, perhaps rule on the fact that it shouldn't take 1 year for a vote of confidence to take place, and that's going to get reduced? I mean, is that the way that isn't that another way of saying that there won't be enough time for a person who comes into a position to be able to perform, and therefore with the shortened length of time that the other party members may say it's time for this person to go, let's bring on the next person, in a sense. Is that where UK politics is heading to?
Well, on the surface it is, but what is coming is the winter and further increased prices, and particularly out of control energy prices. And James is referring to political events right the way around the world, and they all seem to be slightly different. But in fact, the big factors that we've discussed are all playing there. So in British politics, you're going to have to look at the situation, maybe, shall we say, at the beginning of winter. I mean, look at what's going to happen in Germany at the beginning of winter. I mean, the EU is crashing its own economies. Germany, you know, the great powerhouse, its industry is going to be smashed at the beginning of winter. And ordinary people are going to have a tough time as well. So these are the big things. And there's no answer to it. I don't want you to think in terms of, oh, British politics will carry on. We'll just have another prime minister and they'll have a majority of 80. The situation is capable and I think likely to get very sharply worse. Inflation-wise, heating-wise, politics in different countries, they're all starting to attack and start to put pressure on their governments. All this is going to get worse. September, October, November.
Well, what type of monetary policies, what type of economic direction can the UK then take, given the state that it is in right now, James Tweedy, moving forward until you get the new prime minister into his post, who then is going to perhaps try to see what direction it's going to go with the UK? Because at this point, this government is not going to make those major decisions as relayed by the prime minister and other members.
No, I mean, Johnson has said that he's not going to make any big policy changes because he's going, you know, out of deference to whoever takes over from him. Big policy changes. Okay. What needs to happen is that the UK needs to drop its oil and gas embargoes on Russia. It needs to negotiate with Russia and then start buying oil and gas as much as they can get. It would need to persuade its European neighbours to do the same. The USA is already cheating on its own sanctions. It's still importing oil from Russia, but you know, and leaving leaving Europe to, you know, leaving their tanks to run dry, basically. So they've got to persuade the rest of the European Union and NATO countries to do the same. So you know, just get the market so that there isn't that, you know. An unusually high demand in the market elsewhere, things like that. And then it's got to negotiate with Russia and you know, give them back all the assets that they seized and things like that in return for the things. And it's going to mean dropping support for Ukraine. And of course, they need to persuade, change course completely, make a U-turn and persuade Volodymyr Zelensky to make a peace deal with the Russians. With the Russian government, and then of course, you know, what's been going on in the last couple of years, because you know, this is one of the things that meant that Boris Johnson's got very little to show for his 3 years as prime minister, is that we had the COVID pandemic, and people were told to stay at home and not work, but they were paid, you know, they 80% of their wages or whatever were paid by the government while they were doing that, so people had money to spend. But things weren't being produced in the same quantity as before. Work wasn't getting done. And prices of everything shot up. And people were taking that money and spending. They couldn't go on holiday, so they were spending it on home improvements, and you know, you couldn't find a builder or a decorator. You know, they all had like 2-year waiting lists, and they couldn't sure. find enough materials. They couldn't find cement. You know, I had some guy working on my roof. You know, I managed to get him round, luckily, but you know, he had a hard time getting the cement. And so it's great. You need to get more productive industries going. And there needs to be production, real economy. That's Russia's advantage, real economy. Right. It has a load. It is the biggest producer of several commodities that every country needs, and every industry, you know, every country
realize that
heavy industry needs. This is the sort of thing Britain needs to be doing, and it needs to be buying and buying stuff in and getting the supply way higher than demand and bringing those prices down. And that's,
let me jump in since we're just out of time practically here, and give Rodney Shakespeare the final question. Under a minute, if you can, Rodney Shakespeare. What do you think about the way that the UK is going to carry on with the EU in terms of whoever that's going to come in? Will it reduce these post-Brexit tensions when it comes to the way that the UK is going to interact with the EU?
No, the tensions are going to get worse. The situation over the UK breaking the agreement, that's going Northern Ireland. The Northern Ireland unionists have been shoved under a bus. That situation is going to get worse. Yes, you've got to get rid of those sanctions, but the EU are more set on increasing the sanctions and doing preposterous things like thinking that you can cut the price of the oil that you buy from Russia. And these are nonsense things. The whole thing is locked into going worse. And I'm going to make a rule for you, which is quite simple. Anything the Conservatives do now and in the near future will make the situation worse.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much for that. Rodney Shakespeare, Professor of Economics and Political Commentator from London, and also James Tweedy, thank you, from Plymouth in the UK, journalist and commentator.